Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Absolute privilege for me to hold down the fort for Mr. Jones. Stefano, chillaxin, relaxin. And we'll be back with us on Tuesday. Sean Carey here in the Sunbury Motors Studio. Sunbury Motors, Ford Lincoln Hyundai, the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia on the Strip, routes 11 and 15, Hummel's Wharf. So while Steve is at play, we are playing back some of the great interviews we have had on the show, including this hour, the keeper of the cup, Philip Pritchard. Yes, he is the guy all dressed up with the white gloves who hosses the Stanley Cup around the world, that is. And we had a chance to talk to Philip before the 4th of July holiday, so we'll have that for you in just a few. And also, the New York Times, he's been with the New York Times writing about sports media for close to 30 years. Richard Sandomir, acclaimed author, and he has written a book that is revolved around the movie The Pride of the Yankees. That was the movie with Gary Cooper in the role of Lou Gehrig. So we'll talk to Richard about that, the book, and some behind-the-scenes stuff about the movie and Gary Cooper as well. First off, our play-by-play call of the day. Last night here on News Radio 1070 WKOK, Scott Fransky, Cameron Rupp, no. One's not enough. You better make it two.
1-0 the count. Here's the pitch. Swing and a drive. Well hit. Deep center field. Going back. Fisher to the track. He looks up and it's gone. Cameron Rupp over the angled wall to the left of dead center. It's his second homer of the night. His ninth of the year. Another two-run shot for the Phillies backstop. And it's now 9-0 Phillies.
And that was the final last night from Citizens Bank Park. The Fightins winning 9-0. Great effort, too, on the mound by Aaron Nola for the Phillies pitching shutout ball in that matchup. Phillies have the night off, and they'll be starting a four-game series running tomorrow night through Monday at Citizens Bank Park against the Braves. So Atlanta comes to town tomorrow night, and they will play tomorrow night, Saturday, Sunday, and then a Monday afternoon matchup here on WKOK. Jeremy Hellickson will be on the mound for the Phillies tomorrow night, 6:30 for On Deck, and first pitch will be at 7:05. Games earlier today, there are some getaway games. Cleveland over the Angels, 2-1. It was Oakland losing to Toronto. Blue Jays getting the win in 10, 8-4. Washington 15, Milwaukee 2. Washington tied a National League record with 5 home runs in 1 inning. It was in the 3rd inning. Max Scherzer on the mound today for Washington. 9 strikeouts over 6 innings. So just another day at the office for Scherzer. Some other news today. National Football League. Just in over the past hour, the Pittsburgh Steelers have re-signed Alejandro Villanueva to a new 4-year deal. Money numbers and some reports say the deal is $24 million. $14 million will be paid in the first 2 years of that 4-year deal. So Alejandro Villanueva getting a long-term deal for the Steelers. Well, well deserved. And of course, we know his story about his time serving as an Army Ranger. He started all 16 regular season games last year, as well as 3 in the postseason at left tackle. So part of that offensive line that was very crucial that helped Le'Veon Bell break records. And also, fewest sacks. There's only 17 sacks allowed on Ben Roethlisberger last year. That is the fewest of Ben's career. And then you flip it back 2 seasons to 2015. Villanueva played in all 16 games. He started the final 10 after Calvin Beecham was lost for the season with a torn ACL. Villanueva's dream of playing in the NFL began when he was at West Point, but wasn't sure after he was drafted in 2010 that it would ever happen. He got a tryout with the Bengals, He worked out at tight end. He was not signed. So instead, he went out on his first of three deployments as an Army Ranger. He wanted to give football another shot with the Bears. He was again signed, but then he was deployed again, so football was put on the back burner. Then came 2014, signs with the Philadelphia Eagles, but during training camp, he was cut. And that's when Coach Mike Tomlin noticed Villanueva. And the rest, they say, is history. So now a new four-year deal for Alejandro Villanueva for the Pittsburgh Steelers. And don't forget, your home for Pittsburgh Steelers once again this fall is 100.9 The Valley. The Steelers have reported to training camp. James Harrison arrived on a fire truck at St. Vincent College. Antonio Brown arrived in a 1920s Rolls Royce. That doesn't surprise me one bit. So the boys are back in Latrobe. Closed practice tomorrow. First practice for the general public will be on Saturday at St. Vincent College. And also one more story to share with you before we get to Steve's interview with Philip Pritchard, the keeper of the cup. And this Cultmont girl has done good. Let's say congratulations to Maria Ventanarosa. She is now new assistant coach for Michigan State women's basketball. She was the head coach of Miami of Ohio from 98 to 2013. Ventanarosa will be the Spartans recruiting coordinator. She's native of Cultmont. Earned her bachelor's degree in speech communication with a minor in coaching science from Miami of Ohio in 1990. Got her master's in sports administration from Xavier in 1993. And Ventanarosa is still the all-time leading scorer in Pennsylvania girls high school basketball history, 3,823 points. Maria Ventanarosa, the new assistant coach for the Michigan State Lady Spartans. Congratulations to her. Don't forget, you can get in contact with us anytime. Our email is stevejones@wkok.com. stevejones@wkok.com. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at stevejonespsu. This guy follows the Stanley Cup. Yeah, wherever the cup is, chances are Philip Pritchard is there too.
This is a guest I've been looking forward to getting on for a while now. And Sean surprised me when he said, hey, we got him. I said, that's great. He is the keeper of the cup, the Stanley Cup. You now see him in commercials. Philip Pritchard. Philip, it's an absolute pleasure. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you very much. I think if you see me on TV, you're watching too much TV or something.
No, we see you, man. That's great. Where are you right now, as a matter of fact? Where are you going?
I'm in Toronto actually right now at the Hockey Hall of Fame. And so it's a big weekend for us in Canada. It's Canada Day weekend, and I told my wife I'd be home this weekend. So the Cup actually is in Pittsburgh at a sponsored event for the next few days, and then I'm going down next week, and the tour really kicks off then with the players and everything then.
All right, I have to ask you, when you don't have possession of the Cup, do you get, is there a bit of trepidation when it's not in your possession?
If you ask my wife, she'll tell you yes, but you know what, we got a few other guys that travel with the Cup and that, and they're with it. It's fine and safe, and it's actually a great thing to travel with because it doesn't talk back or anything like that, so it's always good to travel with. But it's funny because this year, Steve, I mean, obviously the Penguins win again, and we just go on our GPS and punch in recently found, and we've got all their addresses because it's almost the entire, I think there's three guys that are different. Yeah. But it'll be a great summer in Pittsburgh and area in western Pennsylvania. They love their hockey in Pittsburgh, and it's a great championship city with the Steelers, Pirates, and Penguins over the years. So it's always good to hang out in Steel City.
Okay. How does one get this job? How did you work your way to get to this particular position? Which, look, the Hockey Hall of Fame cherishes the hardware. The NHL cherishes the hardware, so they're going to trust somebody with it. So how did you get to this spot?
It's funny. I took a sports administration course in college in just above Toronto, and it was an internship. And my intern was with the Canadian Hockey League, which is the league that Crosby played in and Marc-Andre Fleury Murray and Matt Murray and Letang, a lot of the guys came out of that league. But when I was interning there, my boss at the time was on the board at the Hockey Hall of Fame and had some great ideas, and through our current president of the Hall, Jeff Denemy, they got me in there. And that was 1988, 29 years ago now. And my first week on the job, the Cup had to go to a minor hockey event, and no one really said anything, and I said, well, I'll go. So I kind of put up my hand, and I got to go, and I guess I've been putting up my hand ever since. But you know what? I would trade it in a second to win that thing.
Give me a couple places you've been to with the Cup that people would never realize that, wow, you went there with it?
Wow. Kandahar, Afghanistan. Over in Kandahar, we went there for the troops. And that was basically just to thank them for what they do and kind of get their mind away from the war in the military at the time, which was Saint-Denis. We Slovenia to Lake Bled in Slovenia, which is one of the only lakes in the world that you can't use motorized vehicles on it. So we had it out in a rowboat going across Lake Bled in Slovenia with Ansi Kopitar from the L.A. Kings when they won.
Right.
We've been in the Ural Mountains in Siberia, paddled at the Detroit Red Wings. And it's amazing when you look at the rosters of all these teams of where these guys are from. I think everyone that picks up a stick or puts on skates wants to play in the greatest league in the world, the National Hockey League. So the rosters are very global these days, and hockey's played in so many countries. So we need a Bora Bora or New Zealand or something like that to win.
I have to ask you about the Kandahar experience. As you went there, what ran through your mind trying to appreciate what they go through on an everyday basis, and how did it impact you?
Well, you know, I mean, it's there's really no comparison of what we do and what the military does. I mean, the military is there for everybody's freedom around the world, whether it's U.S., Canada, Britain, wherever it is. And what they go through is amazing. So to be able to touch them in a way that got their mind off of what they were going through was, I think, extra special for us, because we were going there to thank them. And at the end, they were thanking us for keeping their mind off something. But the whole time that the Cup's over there and that, you're thinking, we're in a war zone here, and it's people are fighting for freedom and everything. And at the end of the day, I mean, hockey is great, and I love it, and it's the greatest sport there is. But I think everyone would agree our freedom, no matter where you're from in the world, is even more important. So to be able to go up to a major or a sergeant or a corporal or whatever, even a private, to say thanks, it's pretty special anytime, whether we're in a base around here or whether it's over in Kandahar. So it's really touching and very patriotic for a weekend like this to talk about that with it's Canada Day here in Canada, and obviously July 4th is coming up in the States, which is another patriotic day. So moments like that, it's hard to describe.
Yeah, no question about that. We know in the history of the Stanley Cup, it's been left on the side of the road. It's been put in swimming pools and so forth. I mean, without naming names, I mean, what's the worst shape it ever got back to you in?
Well, you know what? It's funny when people say that, because we actually stay with the Cup all the time now, so we're always with it.
Oh, good.
And so we're there the entire time. But I think what is neat about it is that most players, and people forget about this, most players have worked a lifetime to get to this point to win the Cup. So everything they do is out of respect for the trophy. Obviously, they take it to sick kids' hospitals, and they take it to family members and coaches and teachers and things like that. And at the end of the day, they have their party. It's usually their buddies that kind of get out of control at their party,
right?
Because they just know them as Billy or whoever it might be.
Right.
So it's at that time, no matter what party you're at, a Stanley Cup party or wherever, the about 9:30, everyone kind of changes a bit. They all get a new personality because of it's party time or whatever. So you got to keep your eyes out and open for it. But from our point, I think respect for the trophy more than anything is the number one thing we look for, because it's 125 years old now. We want it to be another 125 down the road, and it's the greatest trophy there is. So sure, they will put lobsters in it or cereal or whatever have you, but at the end of the day, if it's disrespectful of the trophy, we're not going to let it happen.
You mentioned Kandahar, so we'll put that one aside for a moment. Has there been something along the way where the cup was taken by a player or through a request that really personally touched you when you saw the moment between a cup and an individual, whether it was someone at a children's hospital or something? Is there something that really stuck out to you about that?
Well, there's a couple here. First one, I'm not going to name who it is, because they took it to a cemetery for a past one, and it was just an amazing moment, so powerful, so emotional. And there's been a few guys that have done that, and it's kind of private between them and their loved ones and that. So that is really unique. Last year, Phil Kessel, if everyone remembers Phil Kessel, when he started in the NHL in Boston, he had a cancer scare. And he was 19 or 20 years old at the time, but it got solved and it's in remission. He gets traded to Toronto, and he used to go see the sick kids in Toronto all the time. And he told them if he ever won the cup, he was going to come back to sick kids to share it with them. Well, I don't think he ever thought he would go to another team and win the cup. It was probably beyond his wildest dreams. So he ends up in Pittsburgh winning the cup. And sure enough, he comes back to Toronto Sick Kids Hospital. And we spent, I'm going to say, half a day with the kids. And it was unbelievable. The experience that day with Phil and those kids was, in the 29 years I've been doing it, is in the top five for her. And it was his way of, hey, saying, we can beat this together, and I'm helping you. And whatever it is, we're going to do it. And that was Phil, being Phil Kessel, a kind of quiet guy, but he did, lack of a better word, he did the right thing, I think.
That's incredible. For you, I mentioned earlier, look, we've seen you in commercials, Honda commercials. Obviously, everyone sees you when the cup comes out. So you've achieved some level of notoriety. This is not why you took the job. But have you been taken aback by recognition over the last couple of years because of how this has played out?
Yeah, for sure I have. I mean, if I would have thought when I was 12 years old, if this what I would have been doing in the future, not a chance. I wanted to win the Stanley Cup like most kids.
That's right.
It kind of changed
a
bit
along
the way.
What was your position, by the way?
I played center, actually.
Okay.
And not very good. I think my face got in the way of the puck too many times. But you know what? You go out there, and to be able to stand on the red carpet with Commissioner Bettman when he hands the cup to the captain, and to see it all play out and to know they're that close to it, it's pretty special. I also think it's unique when someone will stop you on the street and say, hey, aren't you the keeper of the cup? Which is, yeah, it's a neat pat on the back. But then my three kids will go, oh, Dad, this is pathetic. Why would that guy want to talk to you? You know, that's what kids are. They bring you back to life pretty fast. For my kids, I'm just their dad. So at the end of the day, if I'm a good role model for my kids, then whatever it may take, I'm there for them.
Oh, believe me, okay? You know, my kids, they're like, we can't take you out anywhere. You know, they want to talk to you about Penn State football and basketball and blah, blah, blah. So we can't take you anywhere. So believe me, I know.
Yeah, you know what it's like. But here's a funny one now. So my girls are, they're late. They're in university now. So I think they bring boys over to the house now, and I'm kind of the decoy. Hey, you know what my dad does? So I think it's a way to pick up boys for them. They use their dad.
Well, well done. See, finally, Dale, that gives all of us hope that happens.
Yeah, so at least I know they're learning stuff because they're using their dad to do this. But you know what? At the end of the day, it's late June, and here we are talking hockey. It's great to me to be able to talk hockey any time of the year. It's pretty special.
Well, it's really neat. All right, you know, here's a fun one for you. How many pairs of white gloves do you go through in a year?
Well, I have every pair that I've ever used, actually. And I'm sure my wife could tell you exactly how many pair because I have them at home. But I wear the pair that we use on the ice that night. I only wear them once. And then I probably use a pair to two pair a week. So I'm probably around 100 pair a week. Okay. 100 pair a year.
A year, yeah.
Yeah, and it adds up. And it's pretty amazing because I have two kind of little passion things that I do. I send my wife a postcard from everywhere I've ever been with it, and I keep my white gloves. And she thinks we have about 3,300 postcards from around the world.
Wow.
So
wow.
I guess it's my little documentary of where the cup has taken me.
When you come home, do you take the cup right to the Hall of Fame, or have there been moments where the cup has spent moments in the Pritchard home?
Yeah, it's both, actually. Depending on where it's going to the next day, and in most cases, it goes to the Hall of Fame. If we are driving and I live west of the city, it comes home. I'm not super most comfortable that way because then it's in my home. I do have a dog and everything, but it's not comfortable having the Stanley Cup sitting in your living room. But you know what? It makes it easier sometimes because I've traveled on the road, flown home, grabbed a car, and then going onward. So it has spent time at my house, but in most cases, I'd prefer it not to.
Away from this, how do you relax? How do you enjoy life? Just talked about your family, so obviously that's one. But what are some other interests that you have besides doing something that is fun, rewarding, but also important for the Hall of Fame?
Away from the cup stuff, you mean?
Yep.
At work,
yep.
Work related?
Anything outside of work, yeah. What do you like to do?
Okay. Well, I mean, I love playing ball hockey, actually. So deck hockey around in the Pennsylvania area, it's called.
Yep.
I love playing that. And I'm a big outdoors person. We go camping all the time, winter and summer camping. Away from everything out in the woods. With my wife, family, and friends and that, and it's always a special time when you get some time, no matter what you do, when you get some time with your family and friends, it's always special, but camping is pretty important to me, and of course, like I said, ball hockey and that.
Well, when you get a chance to do it, thoroughly enjoy it. I thoroughly enjoyed this. This was fascinating. I hope this is not the last time we talk to you.
No, let's chat again later on in the summer.
And enjoy Canada Day like we'll enjoy the 4th of July.
Super. And hey, Steve, maybe we can chat later on in the summer and talk about some of the places the Penguins have taken it this year.
That is something that we're going to count on because I think it's going to be some fascinating stories. Philip, thank you so much. Enjoy this holiday weekend up there.
Thank you. I hope to talk to you soon.
Philip Pritchard, he is the keeper of the cup. And, you know, as an interview, I was looking forward to really doing and enjoying. And you know what? It exceeded expectations, at least for me. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did, but it exceeded expectations. What a great guest. Great guest. Look forward to getting him back on later in the summer. That's a great idea, Ed. I liked it. Because those trips with the cup will be to respective Penguins getting their opportunity with it for the day. We will come back with more in a moment on News Radio 1070 WKOK.
Four city blocks of new Ford trucks. Over 40,000 trucks sold. SMC is where you want to be. Sunbury Motors Ford has over 110 new Ford trucks. And during July, they'll include a complimentary accessory package with the purchase of any new F-150. Through July 31st, receive a tonneau cover, molded splash guards, and window deflectors at no additional charge. SMC is where you want to be because they have the largest selection of new Ford trucks in all of central Pennsylvania.
And that means the biggest savings.
Take
take up to $13,500 off on new F-150s. And SMC has them starting as low as $23,919. Save up to $7,000 on 2017 Ford Escapes, and they're slashed as low as $19,380. Explorers, Edges, and Expeditions have discounts up to $11,000. SMC is where you want to be in July for this mega summer spectacular sale and the complimentary F-150 accessory package. Sunbury Motors in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury.
F-150 accessory package valued at $699. Excludes prior sales and ordered units.
Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sunbury Motors Ford Lincoln Hyundai in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza Sunbury and Sunbury Motors Kia on the strip routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Steve's back with us on Tuesday. Sean Carey here. In just a moment, we will have a replay of Steve's interview with Richard Sandomir from the New York Times. But first off, our sports bozo of the day. This just happened earlier today. We'll give it to umpire Will Little. He ejected not one, not two, but three Toronto Blue Jays in the space of a minute. Blue Jays pitcher Marcus Stroman, former Pittsburgh Pirate, now catcher for the Blue Jays, Russell Martin. They were ejected on the same play in today's A's-Jays game after they took issue with a called ball. Blue Jays manager John Gibbons was ejected just two pitches earlier. So got rid of three guys in under a minute. I know it's getting toward the end of the month, Will Little, but what are you trying to do? You trying to host an ump show up there? You have a quota to hit by the end of the month, so we'll give the sports bozo of the day to Will Little. So there's a book that came out earlier this year, marking the 75th anniversary of the movie The Pride of the Yankees, dealing with Lou Gehrig, and it was Gary Cooper in the role of Lou Gehrig. And it was a really cool book behind the scenes of the movie The Pride of the Yankees, and the book by Richard Sandomir of the New York Times. He joined us on the Steve Jones Show earlier this month.
Richard, thank you so very much for your time. Appreciate it. Your book is an absolutely fascinating read.
Thank you very much. It's good to hear.
Well, let's start with this. First of all, the concept of it. What brought you to write about this movie and do it at this particular moment in time?
Well, it almost didn't happen at this moment in time. I had been noodling around with the idea for a while, inspired by first the resonance of Gehrig's original speech, and then getting more focused on Cooper's version. And then if you get into the Cooper version, then you start getting into the whole movie. So I had a couple of versions of a proposal that didn't work out, and finally with a new agent in 2015, we fixed it up and we sold it. So, but you could say I'd gotten obsessed with the movie.
Cooper's version, of course, is the one that Hollywood puts out there. You had to do a lot of research because the papers were a little bit all over the place as to what the version was, but the luckiest man in the face of the earth is not the last line. It actually is almost at the beginning of the speech, correct?
Correct. It's the second line of the speech, but you know, even that is not an absolute certainty, because if you look at what's left of the original newsreel of Gary delivering the speech, he goes up there without anything at hand. So he's either ad-libbing it, speaking from notes, or speaking from memory of notes or conversation he had with Eleanor or anybody else who contributed. The version that we view as the official version of the speech was something that Eleanor gave to Samuel Goldwyn when she was insisting that the movie speech be the same as the original that Lou gave. And she said, "I am giving this to you from memory." Her memory was had to be somewhat off, because what she offered up was different in certain ways from the newspaper accounts. Nobody was prepared to do a transcript, because nobody was prepared for him to make a speech. So we do know that the luckiest man line, and you know, you've heard about a bad break, and that stuff comes directly from the newsreel. But it's hard to tell what truly was the actual original version.
movies can take artistic license. I'll give you an example of a sports movie that does. The Greatest Game Ever Played with Shia LaBeouf about Francis Ouimet. And it shows Ouimet on the 18th hole of the playoff with Ted Ray and Harry Vardon and handshaking. He knocks in the par putt to win. In reality, he won the playoff by 5 shots. What artistic license is taken in this movie based on your meticulous research?
Well, you know, Eleanor was reading the various scripts as they were being written, and she would send letters to Goldwyn or to Goldwyn through her agent, Christy Walsh, and she would say, "Well, you know, you can portray our wedding the way you want, but Lou's parents weren't there." They were there in the movie. She said, you can't have Miller Huggins, the Yankee manager, sign Lou to a contract wearing a suit in the Yankee office. That would have been Ed Barrow. Well, that's the way it was in the movie. She sort of won a battle where she said, well, you can't have Lou hit 4 home runs in a World Series game. Well, that was changed, if not directly, indirectly, to the scene where Lou promises to hit 2 home runs in a World Series game for the paralyzed the kid with polio in the hospital. So she's I have about 4 or 5 letters that each contain 8 to 10 things where she was in part showing off her baseball knowledge. What's true about the movie is that she was a baseball fan, and she certainly learned more from Lou. And she would try to say, listen, we have to make this as credible as possible because there'll be all sorts of press people out there critical of whenever we make a big whopper. Because, you know, back then, 1942, 41, when she was started writing these letters, the sports film genre barely existed. So people weren't prepared for anything like this. So if the New York sports writers saw all these errors, they were going to pounce. I think only one pounced a little bit. But I think she helped steer them away from big mistakes.
And in the end, I guess she was pleased with the outcome, including the portrayal of Teresa Wright, and she wasn't sure about Teresa Wright originally playing her, correct?
Well, yeah. I mean, put it this way. Teresa Wright was about 18 years younger than Gary Cooper. She'd only done two other movies. Of course, in all three of her first movies, she was nominated for Academy Award and won one of them. I think she had to grow accustomed to Teresa Wright doing it because I think she favored someone like Barbara Stanwyck, who'd been with Cooper and Meet John Doe. But I think when you see Teresa Wright's work, you see someone who acts maturely beyond her years, who clearly made a very credible helpmate to Cooper as Eleanor, and very supportive, a little bit of a teasing relationship. But, you know, Cooper, who could make an emotion in his heart clear with just the flick of an eye, sometimes had these wonderful broad smiles when Teresa Wright was in his presence. It was acting. I'm sure he liked her, but you know, it was clear that they naturally, and through direction and the script, clearly showed that they were a terrific couple. And I think what Eleanor liked about that was, yes, this was going to help perpetuate Lou's image as a great husband. She also enjoyed a very different portrayal of her by Blythe Danner 35 years later, in a movie that was based on Eleanor's own memoir. And Eleanor counseled Blythe to not be as sweet a character as Teresa played her, but I'm a tough cookie, play me more like a tough cookie.
Gary Cooper, of course, he was under contract to Sam Goldwyn, so despite what they wanted to put out as to who would play Garrick, he was going to be the choice. He's right-handed, Lou Gehrig's left-handed. What did it take for him to play the part?
Well, he undertook 6 weeks of lessons from the former National League batting champion Lefty O'Doul, got some other help from Bill Dickey, and you know, there's been a legend that's grown up around the movie that Cooper failed at becoming a lefty, so they filmed all the scenes right-handed and flipped the film. Well, you know, the best available person to analyze this, a curator at the Hall of Fame who looked at this film frame by frame, and who's an expert in the way buttons are put onto uniforms, expert on you know, the labels on vats. He said they, in order to do the flipping, it's more than just, you know, having Cooper bat right-handed and run to third base instead of first base and then have it flipped. It means everybody, the front of everybody's uniform has to have the letters backwards, the numbers have to be backwards. Everybody, not just Cooper. So, he felt that in only one instance, in the minor league montage of scenes where Lou is in Hartford, it's very clear that the Cooper could not learn to throw left-handed, which may be the hardest task of all. And so that was flipped. But, you know, I happen to think that, you know, here's a guy, 40 years old, never played baseball before. I think he did okay. I think, you know, the swing is not Gehrig, but in 1942, there wasn't that great a demand that our actors be great athletes. Nowadays, someone with Cooper's lack of baseball skills would never be cast. We've seen Kevin Costner. We've seen Robert Redford. We've seen Chad McBoseman in 42. Right. We've seen all these athletic actors. You can't have someone like that. And now they're making a movie about Lou Gehrig based on the biography by Jonathan Eich. So it'll be interesting to see the athletic skills of the actor they choose to play Lou.
Sam Goldwyn, though, is not a baseball fan. I think it's safe to say, based on reading this book, he was not a baseball fan. He'd rather see the romantic angle played up. So, in the end, was Goldwyn pleased with the balance that he wanted to see between baseball, which is, of course, part of the heart and soul of Gehrig, and also the romantic part that he thought was essential to a movie?
Well, look, he got 11 Academy Award nominations. It was his best. It grossed more than any other film that he had up to that point. So, yeah, I have to say he was pleased by that. You know, there are incidents even early on where he was fed up with what he saw in his script, and he said, I'm going to cut Babe Ruth's part in half. I'm going to not even hire any of these Yankee ball players. He was very temperamental, but I think he had to be pleased by the reception. The reviews were, I'd say, 85% positive. There was a little bit of criticism that, you know, there isn't much drama in there. But what they were talking about was traditional sports drama. There was no bottom of the ninth home run. There was no great catch. The biggest drama on the field was whether Gehrig would hit that second home run for the kid with polio. And that's the way it was supposed to be. The climax was the speech. And there aren't many sports movies with a better climax than that.
No, I agreed. Eleanor Gehrig, though, was either at the soundstage or an extra when he delivered the speech, right? And
yeah,
her emotions came through?
Yeah. You know, movie magic such as it was in 1942, you're led to believe that Cooper delivered the speech on field, and they were using Wrigley Field in Los Angeles, the other Wrigley Field, as their as the location for the baseball action. But for the 2 or 3 minutes where Cooper is delivering the speech, he's on the soundstage, and Goldwyn invites her to come and watch. And it's, you know, in a dark, everything is dark except for the lights focusing on Cooper, and people hear her crying in the background, and she leaves because she knows, you know, that kind of noise will get picked up. And but there's every reason to believe she loved the scene. It was not necessarily an impersonation, but it was a great suggestion of what was available to watch of Gehrig on the newsreel. And you saw the tears, you saw the watery eyes, you see him wiping his face. You know, Cooper, like I said, Cooper can convey emotion with just the slightest movement of his eyes. And if you notice, there is a point, you have to watch very, very closely, but there is a quick cut where it's clear that, you know, Cooper is on field at Wrigley Field getting ready to make the speech. Then there's a cut that makes it very clear that he's in the soundstage, because the backdrop goes from the real players in behind him to the newsreel.
And so those from our generation, Wrigley Field was the site of the old home run derby. Derby that was on TV. That was a good kill.
It was, and the first home of the Los Angeles Angels.
Yeah, that's right. First home of the LA Angels.
But you know, the funny thing about Home Run Derby is it was played in after the season in front of an empty stadium.
That's right.
You know, they didn't even think of bringing people in. I mean, yeah, it was the fall in LA, but yeah, the players were in there in their uniforms. It was an empty place, but it was so wonderfully hokey. And it was, you know, Wrigley Field was a place, a go-to stadium for a lot of sitcoms. So you know, it was a pretty popular stadium in its time. It no longer exists, but there it is.
When Gary goes overseas during World War II, a soldier shocked him with a request, and it turned out to be something that, in subsequent appearances overseas, he stuck with, and that request was the speech.
Well, yeah, Cooper had gone on a USO tour where he was basically just doing a comedy act, you know, some old Jack Benny sketches with a couple of actresses and an accordionist. And one day in Port Moresby in the South Pacific, one soldier shouts out something like, "Hey, Coop, how about the speech from the Gehrig film?" And, you know, he's not sitting around. You know, an actor doesn't necessarily keep all his lines in his head from previous films. He'd gone on to, he must have made at least two films since then. This is the fall of 43, so it's more than a year and a half since the movie came out. And he says, "Well, give me a few minutes. I got to go into my tent." And it's raining. It's I think it's monsoonal season in the South Pacific. And he says, "I got to write it down." He wrote down what he could remember, and he delivered it. And it was the stunned silence of most likely thousands of soldiers, many of whom probably thought, "Well, I may not survive," and you know, they must have identified in some way with Gehrig, who died before his time of a tragic disease that nobody could understand at that time. So in each of the stops that Cooper made throughout the tour, ending in Sydney, Australia, he delivered the speech, and there was, according to him, there aren't too many accounts of this, at least according to him, there was a similarly respectful reaction to it, because he assumed, and maybe it's more than assumption, that they had seen the movie on the base or wherever they were stationed, and they understood it. And, you know, if you recall in the book, the Damon Runyon wrote an introduction to the film, that was a scroll after the credits, that very short, but it placed Gehrig in sort of the pantheon of soldiers who had lost their lives on the battlefield. And America was, in July of 42 when the movie came out, America was just eight months into its development. So I think the soldiers felt some sort of kinship with him, and Cooper unexpectedly was able to do something that he never did with another movie. You know, how many times does an actor get to deliver memorable lines from a movie that people had seen a year and a half ago, or had been released a year and a half before?
That's Richard Sandomir from the New York Times. His book is The Pride of the Yankees, Lou Gehrig, Gary Cooper, and the Making of a Classic, available wherever you buy books. Best of the Steve Jones Show will continue tomorrow. We'll have replays with Tim Frazier, Jim Miller, John U. Bacon, and Tim Kirkshin here on News Radio 1070 WKOK.